DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet, and I'm Charlotta Lomas. Coming up on the show today, as the world reaches a climate change crossroads, which path will we take?
We either say this thing is too big for us, this task cannot be done, we will end up with a planet warming by 4, 5, 6 or even 12 degrees. It would be the end of the world as we know it. Or we say we are doing the transformation ourselves. And if we do it right, it will be the next big project of modernity and it will give our life a new meaning.
Plus, a luxury retreat in Italy that's farming snails for their slime. How?
With this machine, as you can see, they feel pleasure because after the extraction, they don't die. It's like a spa for snails.
That's coming up. Stay tuned. Most of the time when we hear about climate change, it's linked to messages of doom and gloom, that time is running out as the Earth heats up. But today, we'll start the show off with someone who calls himself a desperate optimist when it comes to our chances of coping with a future of climate change. Professor Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber is a physicist and founding director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. Not only has he just helped design a carbon roadmap for how our society can wean itself off fossil fuels, he's also calculated what our chances are of actually achieving this very ambitious goal. Professor Schellnhuber sat down with me at DW while he was in Bonn this week, and I began by asking him where the world is at with its carbon budget.
We spent 500 billion tons of pure carbon, so that's a huge amount, of course. So that means we have more or less spent 1,800 billion tons of CO2 already since the inception of the Industrial Revolution. If we want to hold the 1.5 degrees line, which is the ambitious goal of the Paris Agreement, we have left maybe 300 billion tons, which means more or less the budget of 10 years if we do business as usual. If we want to hold the 2 degrees line, which is more realistic, we have another 20, 30 years to go, but not more actually. So it's a very tight budget.
And in order to meet the tight budget that you mentioned, what do you see as being the major things that need to happen between now and then?
Actually, there will be a paper appearing in magazine Science, so one of the top magazines where I'm a co-author next week, which is designing what we call a carbon roadmap. So it means precisely how to stay within the carbon budget, what has to happen in industry, in domestic energy use, in agriculture, land use, and so on. And it's quite mind-boggling, actually. We do sort of decadal steps. And for example, by 2030, we have to phase out the combustion engine, and we have to phase out completely the use of coal for producing power. By 2040, we probably have to replace concrete and steel for construction by wood, clay, stone, so the old materials again, and so on. So you can come up with a complete narrative, more or less, how we can reach the Paris goal. But by the way, this is not the only possible narrative. There are several ones, but all have in common, they are completely transformative.
So we do have an international climate agreement signed and ratified. Are we on track to meet our emissions reductions targets, do you think?
I mean, here Germany actually has the more ambitious goal here within the European Union, the 40% reduction by 2020. It looks fairly bleak, actually. With the current policies in place, we will not even meet our own target, the 40% reduction. Something fairly disruptive needs to happen, like closing down some of the operating coal-fired power stations. European Union is under-ambitious, clearly, would have actually to raise the ambition immediately after Paris, what did not happen actually, so it's a very sluggish process. Globally, there are some good news actually. China probably even has peaked emissions already now, which is amazing really, India has an extremely ambitious solar energy program now, investing a lot. So the only black horse in the race is the US.
Which leads me to my next question. The US President Donald Trump has threatened to pull out of the Paris Accord. How big an impact would this have on the international climate action that we've achieved so far?
Yeah, that's the $1 billion question, of course. And I mean, first of all, it's not clear whether Trump will pull the US out of the Paris Agreement. I don't think he will. I think, like other laggards and sort of obstructors in the past, like Saudi Arabia, the US will just stay on board and try to slow down all the processes. So you have a much bigger procrastination power if you're in than if you're out, actually. So that's my expectation. What effect will it have? I would say 10 years ago, this would have been a complete disaster for climate policy. Now with China, biggest emitter, and actually now the biggest investor into renewables, with the Asian economies now slowly changing, I think the world could achieve climate protection even without the US.
Scott Pruitt, who now heads the US Environmental Protection Agency, recently denied carbon dioxide as a major contributor to global warming.
Measuring with precision human activity on the climate is something very challenging to do, and there's tremendous disagreement about the degree of impact. So no, I would not agree that it's a primary contributor to the global warming that we see. Or we don't know that yet.
His comments go against the 97% consensus of the world's scientists. Now, scientists generally tend to stay out of politics, but do you think, given the current political climate there, that scientists will become more politicized and outspoken?
I have the big privilege to work in a former office where Albert Einstein was doing his job. And you know, he's one of the greatest geniuses and physicists of all time. And he was a very political animal, actually. That did not impact in any way on the quality of his equations. So you can actually do both. I think now this blatant denial, actually, of the scientific system as such, it's not just climate science, it's the laws of physics, more or less, are put in doubt. And laws of physics are not passed by a parliament, by the way, I have to insist on that. I think if the very system of the scientific method and the scientific research is in doubt, then scientists have to take to the street in the end and have to demonstrate that, hey, we are doing a job for you, actually. We scientists who love to sit in our ivory towers and untainted by the dirt of the real world and so on, we have to take to the street, we have to speak up, we have to leave our ivory towers, and we have to communicate to everybody that we want to be part of the solution.
World leaders will gather here in Bonn in November for the next round of climate negotiations. Is the political will on climate action still there, do you think? And how important are these talks?
Yeah, I have participated in, I think, 15 or 18 of these COPs. These talks are extremely frustrating, and every time you think this is the last one and you will never attend again, but there is now a show in town, you have to do it. And so in the end, I think what we saw in Paris was an amazing achievement, that each and every nation more or less said, yes, 2 degrees, climate action. Now, the other thing is, of course, how realistic is an agreement which is multilateral, unanimous even, like in Paris. And here I think it's the task of the science to tell stakeholders, ministers, chancellors, presidents, that the job to be done is extremely daunting, is actually unparalleled. It is more or less, it is doing an industrial revolution, at least of the scale of the original industrial revolution, where fossil fuels were sort of taken on board for creating the modern society. But this time we do not have 200 years for achieving and doing the job. We have only 30 years. And this is unprecedented, absolutely. So in a way, we are at the crossroads now. We either say this thing is too big for us, this task cannot be done, when we will be transformed by nature, because we will end up with a planet warming by 4, 5, 6, or even 12 degrees, it would be the end of the world as we know it. And here I have all the evidence. Or we say we are doing the transformation ourselves. And if we do it right, it will be the next big project of modernity, and it will give our life a new meaning. So, go for it.
You're very positive. That's good. So many, many cities and countries are showing a strong commitment for climate action, as you say. And there's also a growing global momentum at the grassroots level. How do you see the role of civil society moving forward on climate action?
Actually, if you would have asked me 10 years or even 5 years ago, I would have said this is just a sort of a nice add-on and fairly unpolitical in the end. Over the last years, I've come to the personal conclusion, I may be wrong, but I feel that the bottom-up, the grassroots action is actually the most important at all. I'm a huge supporter of the so-called divestment movement. That means, yes, in the end, it's economically efficient to switch to renewables. Yes, polluter has to pay, you have to pay for the carbon emissions. Yes, we have to get rid of air pollution and so on. This will come around if we have a century time left, but we don't. So what I think is that each and every person takes a moral stance, actually, and says, I don't want to be part of the destruction of the world. I want to be part of the preservation.
So how optimistic are you that the global economy can decarbonize before we reach the threshold of global warming?
When I calculated, semi-tongue-in-cheek, but it's not complete nonsense, try to calculate what is the chance that we will decarbonize fast enough in order to hold the 2 degrees line, for example. And my result is, the chance is 19%, 19. So when you tell this to a general public, they say, oh my God, only 19%, that's a very slim chance. And I said, come on, it could be 0 or 1 or 2. If everything is at stake, and I really feel human civilization as such is at stake, when 19% is a brilliant chance. So you see, I'm a sort of a desperate optimist. it's not a brilliant chance in reality, but it's the only choice we have.
That was Professor Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber, physicist and founding director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research here in Germany. From political animals to the slimy kind. Snails, or les escargots as the French call them, have long been popular on restaurant menus across southern Europe. Italians have been farming snails for generations. But more recently, they've been farming them not for the animal's flesh, but for its slime. In ancient times, snails were used for beauty treatments, and the slime they excrete is said to contain ingredients similar to those found in skincare products. Despite limited scientific research into its benefits, the demand for snail slime products is booming. Our reporter Danny Mitzman went to find out what the fuss is all about.
My name is Monica Fissore.
Just 50 kilometres southeast of Turin, Monica Fissore's farm could be mistaken for a very large vegetable patch. The tiny size of her animals means you don't need acres of fields to breed them. But if you peep under the temporary covers, protecting the neat leafy rose from the icy temperatures, you can see thousands of tiny hibernating shells. Monica's farm is called Il Giardino della Lumaca, the snail's garden.
How long have you been farming snails? Da quanto tempo?
Da 4 anni, from 4 years.
And how many snails? Do you know how many, more or less?
There are 1 million snails. We do the snails only vegetable, especially sunflowers.
Why sunflowers?
Because the snail like much sunflowers. Sunflowers, carrots and cabbage. The food is very important, is most important.
Until recently, Monica's snails were destined for the dinner table, but now she's selling them for their slimy discharge. Monica's one of 8 snail farmers in the small town of Cherasco in Italy's Piedmont region, home to the International Snail Breeders Institute. For the past 40 years, the institute's been running training programs and carrying out research into the helix snail species. From nature to gastronomy, science to economics, they cover every aspect of snail husbandry. Simone Sampo, the institute's president, shows me around the premises. Snail-shaped gadgets, as well as edible and non-edible snail products, are everywhere you look. Simone holds weekly seminars for potential breeders who come from all over the world. He's been breeding garden snails for 21 years and spent nearly a decade trying to find the perfect way to extract their slime.
In passato si buttava del sale o dell'aceto.
In the past, they threw salt or vinegar on them, stimulating the snails to produce slime, but also killing them immediately afterwards. It not only killed the snails, but also led to a much lower concentration of mucopolysaccharides in the slime than the snail normally produces when it feels fine.
Mucopolysaccharides, like hyaluronic acid, are naturally present in connective tissue and important for hydration and lubrication. Happy snails, Simone concluded, would produce better quality, richer slime.
In 9 anni di studi siamo riusciti finalmente a creare.
My idea was to prevent the snail from suffering and to make a machine that would avoid contamination and allow extraction from the same snails more than once. With our machine, the Muller 1, we extract uncontaminated, standardized, cruelty-free slime. We don't kill the animal.
Free cruelty, quindi senza uccidere.
The Muller 1 is housed at the back of the institute in its own sterile lab. The freestanding machine is stainless steel with 2 plexiglass domes on top, about the size of a takeaway hot dog stand. But instead of sausages, there are over 1,500 snails inside the domes, and the drip trays not for fat, but for slime. Communications manager Sara Borio shows me the machine in action.
With this machine, as you can see, they feel pleasure because after the extraction, they don't die. It's like a spa for snails. This is ozone. So with the ozone, the snails are purified of the bacteria and the molds. Half an hour of ozone shower or spray of ozone, then break, and then it starts the second part, which is the stimulation part with this stimulation formula made by natural elements. As you see, with 20 kilos of snails, you can produce in 1 hour, because the cycle lasts 1 hour, more or less 3 kilos of slime. The slime go inside the container there. It's a pure slime.
That slime in that plastic container, does it smell?
It has a natural smell. If you want, we can you can.
Yeah, try. I'd like to have a sniff.
Who can sniff?
It smells very pleasant, a bit earthy, a bit grassy. Natural.
Yes. There is not this sense of disgust, like, I don't know, a fish or something. It's very, very pleasant, I think.
It's herby. Yeah. I didn't expect it to smell nice.
Yeah.
Despite limited evidence supporting the health and cosmetic benefits of snail slime, there's nevertheless been an explosion in the sales of pharmaceutical and cosmetic products containing the stuff. So much so, the Institute's just launched its own range.
It's important for a consumer to be sure when they buy a product that this product contains snail slime in reality.
Do people react with disgust when you say there's snail slime in your products or your products are based on snail slime?
Sometimes, yes, because I think there is this mental block. But there is this concept nowadays that we need to start using natural product, not chemical product, you know? The consumer is more aware of what he eats, what he put on the face, on the body. So there is a growing market in this natural product. There is space also for the snail slime.
Slime has also seen its way into cough syrups as well as beauty products. Over the past 6 months alone, there's been about a 40% increase in demand for the raw product from the cosmetic and pharmaceutical industries. Consequently, there's been an inevitable increase in demand for snails for slime extraction. The number of Italian snail farms has more than trebled in the last 2 decades, and Simone Sampo believes the trend will continue both at home and abroad. Unlike the animals themselves, this is a business that's definitely not moving at snail's pace. Danny Mitzman, DW, Cherasco, Italy.
After decades of absence, wolves have returned to Germany, multiplying since the first returnee was caught on infrared camera close to the Polish border in the year 2000. The presence of this maligned bad boy has provoked strong opposition, but conservationists insist that, if properly monitored, these great predators can play a valuable role in our ecosystems. East of Germany, in the Carpathian Mountains of Slovakia, wolves, bears and even the shy lynx have long been a feature of mountain life. But even there, they are under threat. In Kralovany, our reporter Christian Cummins joined a group of conservationists tracking their trail.
In February, the Carpathian Mountains of northern Slovakia are covered in a thick layer of crunchy snow. Tomas Hulik, a Slovak biologist, is leading a team of researchers clad in snowshoes and roaming the steep tracks of the remote forests on a scientific mission.
Try to looking for the wolves, lynxes, maybe not hibernating bears, and very rarely maybe for the wildcat. And why? Because we are making here the basic research of big predators in Velká Fatra National Park.
His assistants are not scientists. They're volunteers who've travelled from all over the world to assist in the work scientists like Thomas are doing, logging the things they find in GPS machines. Jill Mayo from England and Idan Scheinberg from Israel record the coordinates of a print find.
49.0 34.4.5, that's the north.
34.5.
Yeah, and the east is 19.
Yeah.
08.
03.1.
It's painstaking work and the hiking is long and arduous, following the tracks of agile creatures over rough, icy, steep terrain. Ed Dural, for example, has come all the way from Washington, D.C. in the United States to stay in a humble cabin and give his time to the project. His motivation?
Contributing to the work that people like Tomas, you know, people like that, what they are doing, helping to further the science and the causes he's trying to take on. I know one of the things that he does with his data is he tries to report to the commission that grants hunting permits, and he has data that can show, you know, factual wolf populations versus just the speculation. And so I think sometimes, maybe not just in Slovakia, but in other places, the population gets inflated, perhaps, so they will issue more hunting permits.
Indeed, hunting remains a big threat to the wolf, says Tomas Hulik, who claims the hunting quotas are set dangerously high.
The wolves can be hunt from 15 November till January, or till quota is filled. Usually the quota, I think that this year was around 70 animals. And when you imagine that we have roughly around 300, 400 wolves, and each year the hunters are allowed to shut down nearly one third of population, so it's quite horrible.
And yet, he argues, along with the bears, wolves should be valued for keeping the forests healthy by controlling the numbers of herbivores that feast on the young stripling trees and keeping the forest floor clean.
All predators are really very good. They have their really very important role in the ecosystems. When we don't have wolves, for example, we will have a lot of wild boars, a lot of deers. They can make some damages on the plants, on the forest. The same with the bears. When we don't have a bear, so we will have a lot of carcasses around in the forest.
As we hike up into the higher reaches of these Carpathian forests, the pine needles are frozen white, and we make an exciting discovery, the print of a reclusive lynx.
The waypoint is 002. The species is lynx.
Tomas reaches into his backpack and pulls out a box-like piece of equipment, which he starts to tie to a nearby tree stump.
Just now we are setting up the camera trap, because we found a place where lynxes mark their territory. Just now we are in the mating season of the lynxes, so they are also communicating by urine. So we hope that lynx will mark also our camera trap with urine and we will see it then.
Towards the end of the day's hike, we even come across the tracks of a bear, which surprises me, a non-scientist. I thought they'd be hibernating.
Usually the bears are sleeping or hibernating, but they are hibernating only because they don't have a food. So and in the moment we have a lot of beech fruits in the forest, so for that reason the bear don't have to sleep.
Here's a little kind of a tree stump. It's got some markings on it. This is where a bear comes and rubs himself. Why?
They are leaving the messages for other bears. So that's my territory and so on, so on. So it's something like a telephone spot, or they are leaving the messages.
This is bear Facebook.
Yeah, that's it.
Bears are often feared, but Noro Sommer, a Slovak wildlife photographer, says with no deadly attacks here in 100 years, there is no problem with humans and bears living in the same area.
People are shy about the bears, but the reality is completely different. There is no human kills from the bear in the last 100 years in Slovakia, so it's really not so bad how his reputation is.
Later, back at the base, a cabin-like house above the small town of Kralovani, Thomas, Jill, Ed and Edan gather with the two other research teams who've been mapping different parts of the mountains.
9 was a wolf and 30 was a wolf.
And what was from 29 was a wolf? Okay, so
bottom half.
By the end of the week, they will have collected some thorough scientific data.
There is I7, I8.
Malika Fetak is the overall leader of this project, organised by a non-profit conservation group called Biosphere Expeditions. She says the work these citizen scientists do is very valuable.
A field biologist is no more than a stamp collector. So you need eyes and feet to walk the ground and to look for signs and tracks and feces and record that all in the data sheet.
For the participants, she says, it's a glimpse into the wealth of nature.
It's a very intensive personal experience of, you know, it's learning. It's seeing the forest and the nature with different eyes, because you learn so much more when you go out with experienced people, scientists, local people, to make you aware about what's out there.
And it's an adventure, albeit a tough one, says Edan Scheinberg.
The whole walking with snowshoes, yeah, it's quite different than what I'm used to. That's the hard part, but it's part of the experience, I think, and it's part of the sense of, you know, of achievement. You know that I walked 10 to 20 miles in snowshoes on the mountains. Not something you get to do in Israel, so yeah, it's fun.
Christian Cummins, Deutsche Welle, Kralovani, Slovakia.
And that report ends this week's show. For more episodes, you can download the Living Planet podcast on iTunes, listen to us on SoundCloud, or visit our website at dw.com/environment. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at DW Environment. Thanks to our studio team, Eliana Giarducci, Michael Springer, and Natalie Muller. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Catch you next time.